welcome history friends, patrons all, to Poland Is Not Yet Lost, episode 9. Last time we examined King Charles XII of Sweden's gamble. We looked at the Swedish invasion of Russia, which began, as we noted, with very high hopes and grand ambitions for the future of the land. Having trounced all of his enemies convincingly, King Charles seemed destined to triumph once again against the backward, barbarous, and inferior Russian people. The vast swathes of land which the Tsar claimed to rule would soon be the newest Swedish acquisition, and Charles XII, as the most glorious king of Sweden that Sweden had ever known, would conquer all the way to Moscow, remove any trace of Tsar Peter's regime, and then ensure that the future brilliance of Sweden would be established in Europe for centuries to come. Except, as we saw, things hadn't really panned out like Charles had hoped. 1708 was an eye-opening year for the 26-year-old Swedish king. He had been unable to properly trap and defeat the Russians. The Russians that he did fight seemed to be a lot more capable than he remembered them being before. And also, most importantly and most devastatingly, Russia's lands were absolutely destroyed as per the Tsar's orders. This meant that Charles's men rapidly ran out of food and ammunition, not to mention the fact that the weather continued to harry their every move, and they were being sniped at by the peasantry and guerrilla soldiers alike. Speaking of bad weather, the already demoralized Swedes had been forced to spend the worst winter in European memory, mostly wholly exposed to the elements, with the result that by the time the year 1709 dawned, Charles had lost 3,000 men just to exposure alone. While Charles suffered, Tsar Peter's luck seemed only to increase, but there had been casualties. Swedish intrigues had flipped the Cossack hetman, Ivan Mazepa, but his people didn't follow his lead, at least not yet. Just as Charles needed a win, Peter would eventually have to confront the Swedes in battle if he wanted to change the ongoing narrative. With the West already having recognised Stanislaus as king back in Poland, there was a lot of work for Peter to do if he wanted to change people's minds. The best way he could change their minds was not to keep withdrawing into the vastness of Russia, sensible though this may have been strategically. A key victory against Lievenhaupt, one of Charles's lieutenants who was supposed to bring much-needed supplies, and the resulting destruction of those supplies, forced the Swedish king to live off the land. But it also made Charles much more desperate and daring, and Peter knew better than most people that it was wise to never count Charles out. 1709, it was clear, would be a pivotal year in the Russo-Swedish War. By its end, everything would have changed. So let's resume our narrative now, my dear lovely patrons, as we take you to spring 1709. It is often asked, with regard to Russia, how triumphant military leaders made the same mistake in each century. Charles XII, example, it is said, should have proved to the likes of Napoleon, and then to Hitler, that one could not wage a war in Russia, least of all in the depths of winter, and expect to win. But at the same time, we often neglect what to Charles XII would have been his example. What I mean by that is, in Charles's mind, there was no reason why his invasion shouldn't succeed, since almost exactly 100 years before Charles's action, perhaps the first Western invasion of Russia ever had been launched. Then, it had been a total success. But this hadn't been the Swedish, the German, or the Austrian invasion of Russia. Instead, it had been an invasion of Russia undertaken by the Poles. That the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth was capable of launching a successful invasion of Russia, capturing Moscow and enabling the King of Poland at the time, Sigismund III, to place his own son on the throne of Tsar, must have seemed like a bad joke to those living in 1709 rather than 1609. How much everything had changed in the space of a century. During that time, Poland had been reduced to a de facto vassal of the Swedish crown, with Charles's puppet king, Stanislaus, in place, and now Russia was resisting his advances with a fury and resilience quite unlike the Russia of 1609, when Moscow had been captured by Commonwealth soldiers. Peter had played no small part in ensuring that Russia was a world away from the old Tsardom, which seemed to collapse in on itself for nearly two decades, a period in Russian history known as the Time of Troubles, and which only ended with the ascension of Michael Romanov, for the record, Tsar Peter's great-grandfather, who became Tsar Michael in 1613. Peter was mindful of his country's past, just as surely as Charles would have known of Poland's successful invasion of Russia a century before. During the Commonwealth's invasion of Russia at that time, a single battle, that of Klushino, had eradicated Russian resistance, and before the year had ended, the armies of Sigismund III were in Moscow. Such rapid progress had no doubt been expected by Charles, and he had certainly envisioned, similarly, stunning victories to crown his triumphant advance. Yet, throughout the entire Russian venture, Charles had enjoyed very few moments of elation, and still fewer signs of actual progress. Instead, for much of 1708, he'd been forced to move further south in a bid to avoid serious opposition and claim untouched resources, with the result that Charles's campaign appeared to be floundering by the time 1709 dawned. Charles's officers and the civilians that he took with him believed they had the solution. Charles should withdraw to Poland, seek reinforcement from Stanislaus, and make use of the provisions of the major Commonwealth cities. Once he was there, Charles could bide his time and try again. But to Charles, this idea was impossible. It was the antithesis of his character to retreat, not least because it would embolden Peter to act more aggressively, but also because it would signal that the last year of campaigning, in addition to all the suffering, had been for naught. Charles couldn't allow it. He wouldn't allow it, even though he must have known, deep down, that his manpower and resources were dwindling steadily downwards. Charles's army possessed very little of its confidence, its panache, or the spark of brilliance which had seemed to characterize it in the previous campaigns. The Russian winter, the Russian soldier, and those blasted Russian lands themselves had all chipped away at Sweden, compelling Charles to send a series of increasingly urgent, but still calm and collected messages to the puppet King Stanislaus back in Poland. If the King of Poland would send his 8,000 reinforcements, along with some much-needed provisions, then Charles reasoned there would be no need to withdraw. Charles was also busy conducting diplomacy with Peter's troubled neighbours, and he believed a withdrawal would scare such overtures away. The first negotiations were to do with the Cossacks, but their promise proved illusory. The Cossacks remained divided over the decision to ally with the Russians or take on new Swedish masters, and any new recruits were hard to come by. Furthermore, Peter had already outflanked these negotiations, and he launched a strategically brilliant attack upriver against different Cossack bases. This crippled their once fearsome power and effectively signalled to the rest of the Cossacks what the price would be if they also defected. With the Cossacks outflanked in this way, Charles was forced to rely on those desperate turncoats, people who knew that if they returned to their Cossack homeland, they'd be killed by the now Russian-approved Hetman. Because of this, these Cossacks fought with great tenacity and courage, but they were very few in number at the same time. Another possible source of allies could be found in the Tartars, whose Khan, Delvet Giray, absolutely despised the Tsar for the Russian gains made during the previous Russo-Turkish War. Delvet Giray was in a difficult position, though, because he was technically a vassal of the Ottoman Sultan, and he would thus have to acquire approval from that Sultan to act before launching any kind of attack. To do this, the Khan sent his emissaries to Constantinople, pleading with the Sultan and telling him that the Russians were on the ropes and that intervention now would tip the balance in favour of the Turk and avenge previous losses. The temptation proved great, and for a time the Turks seemed to be considering breaking the armistice that they had with the Russians and launching an attack all of their own in conjunction with the Tartars. Such an offensive would have surely spelled doom for Peter, especially if he proved unable to prevent the Turks and Charles from linking up, which the determined Swedes would certainly have done. The only person capable of preventing this dream team from striking against Russia was the Russian ambassador to Constantinople, a man by the name of Peter Tolstoy. Tolstoy was a prominent diplomat and courtier, and yes, if you find his surname familiar, that noble family name would eventually spit out the famous Leo Tolstoy in 1828. But for now, Peter Tolstoy was content to do all in his power to prevent the Swedish-Ottoman Union. To do this, he engaged in devious, and some would say genius, practices. seeing the Tartar emissaries arrive in April 1709 to petition the Turkish Sultan for war with Russia, Tolstoy got to work. He worked on rumours first, claiming that the Swedish and Russian rulers were about to make a peace with the marriage of Charles to Peter's sister. So therefore there was no need for the Turks to intervene in this war. He also put it about that the Swedish army was in dire straits, which wasn't exactly fiction. But he also insisted that the Tsar would triumph any day now, which wasn't all that certain. When all else failed, Tolstoy was well equipped to simply bribe the Turks and Tartars with packages of gold as an incentive to leave Constantinople and end such foolish talk of an alliance between the fearsome Tartars and the eager Swedes. Many had been in Tolstoy's position and failed, and if the Tartars had pushed hard enough, they surely would have been successful, since an ambassador can only do so much. Incidentally, it appeared as though the diplomatic mission sent by the Tartars didn't desire war as much as those Tartars who waited eagerly on the borders with Russia for news. The Khan, in any case, would not move without the Sultan's approval, and this was denied when he learned of Tolstoy's varied versions of the truth. There would be no Tartar intervention after all, at least not yet. As Charles waited in Ukraine for the snows to melt and for winter to finally end, 1709 continued to be an eventful one for Peter. He remained concerned that Charles would wheel down to the Crimea and destroy his burgeoning fleet there, so he elected to travel to the dockyards himself and see what could be done. In the meantime, Peter had ordered portions of the Russian army to scout along the Russian border with Poland in anticipation of those reinforcements that Charles had requested from King Stanislaus. With these units behind Charles and Peter's main force in front of him, the prospects for Swedish success appeared bleak even before the snows had melted in 1709. Yet, even now, Peter offered Charles an out. In a breathtaking what-if scenario, the Tsar offered to give virtually everything back to Charles if he could only keep St. Petersburg. There was no mention of holding all the Baltic, no mention of reparations after the Tsar had destroyed his own lands, and perhaps most interestingly enough, no mention from Peter of removing King Stanislaus from the Polish throne. Although Peter did not believe Charles could inflict the mortal blow on his regime, in the state that his armed forces were in, the tenacious Swedish king had demonstrated his resolve in the past. After underestimating him one too many times before, Peter seems to have learned his lesson, and as a result, he gave Charles a peace deal very much at odds with what anyone else in Charles's position could reasonably have expected. The sole reason for this diplomatic generosity was, it has to be said, the cumulative effect of King Charles's reputation for desperate actions and from stealing stunning victories from the jaws of defeat. Even with all the odds against him, and the odds apparently heavily in Russia's favour, Tsar Peter still could not bring himself to believe that it would be as simple as defeating the outnumbered, outflanked, and outgunned Swedish king who was thousands of miles from home. Much like Charles himself seems to have done, the Tsar here seems to have believed in the hype. Whether Charles could be properly defeated or not was one issue, but Peter had at least learned that his own soldiers could stand up to their Swedish counterparts. Where once they'd seemed hopelessly outmatched, now Russian soldiers could be reasonably expected to hold their positions and not just break and flee straight away as they'd done once. Where Peter had been greatly relieved by this upturn in Russian professionalism, it seems to have taken Charles completely off guard, and he never seemed to have fully accepted that, on a given day, Peter's legions could be just as formidable as his. The Swedish king still behaved as though his much smaller force could be the equal of his enemy, and this explains his later behaviour at Poltava, where Charles would attack a force over three times his size, hoping to repeat the exploits of the Battle of Narva from 9 years before. At Poltava, Charles would learn conclusively that the Russians had learned their lessons, just as the rest of Europe became aware of a new military power entering into the concert of nations. The arrival, at last, of the Ukrainian spring in late April 1709 seemed to fill King Charles with a measure of optimism. He determined to make a play for Poltava, a commercial town approximately 200 miles southeast of Kiev. Since he lacked the boats necessary to cross the raging Vorskla River, which was necessary if he was to move further east, Charles believed that a strike at Poltava would at least result in a strategic victory, where his army could then replenish itself in a fortified base while it awaited reinforcements. However, what Charles actually hoped for was that by attacking Poltava and laying the first siege of his campaign, Russian armies to the east and west would be compelled to attack him, whereupon he could turn the tables and destroy a great Russian army in the battle he so desperately needed. A great triumph against overwhelming odds would remind both the Tsar and the rest of Europe of this Swedish king's status, while it also would have the effect of drawing other powers in, such as the Tartars. After pounding the town for some time and urging the mining ever onwards, by the middle of May 1709, it was becoming clear to Charles's subordinates that the king was playing for time. Did he even really want to capture Poltava? Charles had reduced the rate of bombardment so much at Poltava that it did little more than irritate the garrison of some 5,000 Russian soldiers there. In fact, Charles was watching his plan come together, because as he waited in his camp outside Poltava, on the other side of the Vorskla River, he was aware that the Russians were swarming, trying to move messages and men across, trying to snipe or capture any stray Swedes, while Charles's own men did the same. The tension was reaching a climax between the two sides when on the 4th of June 1709, something very special happened. Tsar Peter himself arrived in the Russian camp. His appearance put new steel into his soldiers, while the arrival of 10,000 reinforcements who came with him also helped matters. Once again, Charles watched the disparity of numbers grow between himself and his adversary, but once again he remained calm. Peter understood that Charles was now confined in a steadily narrowing space, and if he couldn't strike a decisive blow, he would be forced to break out with his army. For a time, it seemed as though Charles fully intended to seize Poltava and use it to make his stand, yet even while Peter fussed over this possibility, Charles seemed reluctant to land the killer blow on the Poltava garrison. After some time, Peter found out why. It wasn't all just for show. In fact, the Swedes were running critically low on powder, and would soon have to either make a move or withdraw. With the two monarchs so near to each other, it seemed evident that the great trial was drawing near also. In the recent past, Peter had seemed reluctant to risk it all in a single battle, but the stakes were now so high that he didn't seem to have a choice. He had either wandered deliberately into Charles's attractive trap, or he had arrived to lead his army to glory against a legendary 26-year-old king. Either way, Peter believed, by the end of June, something would have to move. Charles knew well that his own position was strategically desperate. He couldn't withdraw from the shrinking camp in which he found himself without some extreme difficulties, and he appreciated also that reinforcements, as well as a clear passage forward or backwards, had been removed as potential hopes. Peter's force on the other side of the Vorskla River, watching the Swedish moves nervously, was in fact twice the size of Charles's force. Yet for all of this, Charles's evident self-confidence and the experience of history made Peter believe that the task ahead would be a grim one, where success was far from guaranteed. Whatever the circumstances in which Charles found himself, everything could be turned around in the space of a pitched battle, especially one where both monarchs took part. After a few skirmishes and attempts by the Russians to cross the river, both sides seemed to settle in for a grand battle. It was just at that inopportune moment, while examining the troops, that King Charles received a terrible wound in his foot, which festered and inflicted a terrible fever upon him as the infection spread. As the infection spread, so did the drop in morale. Morale plummeted in the Swedish camp as they learned that their king was not, in fact, invincible. As he lay convalescing between the 19th and 21st of June, Peter's forces, informed of the low morale, crossed the River Vorskla en masse before anything could be done about it. Now that they were on the same bank as the Swedes, and there in force, they could at any moment move forward to attack them. But Peter ordered his forces to stay put while they waited to see what would happen. In the distance, some Russians claimed that they could see the King of Sweden being brought amongst his men on a stretcher to boost morale, but Peter would not be drawn. As the 22nd of June passed, Charles's illness gradually receded, but he then received another blow. Messengers from Poland and the Tartars confirmed that reinforcement was impossible. King Stanislaus cited the difficulty in abandoning his homeland and marching with the majority of his soldiers, and he noted that he didn't trust his more unruly subjects to keep the peace at home while he was away. Convinced that only armed force could ensure his throne's legitimacy, Stanislaus was in constant fear that Augustus would return with the support of the army if he left the Republic. And so, Stanislaus elected to stay. So that was one ally gone. From the Tartars, though, the news wasn't much better. As we've already seen, Peter Tolstoy had worked wonders to persuade the Sultan to remain at peace with the Tsar. And with their master at peace, the Tartar agents had to confirm that they were unfortunately bound by their master's wishes, and they could not get involved with this war either. At this moment, on the 22nd of June, his advisors received this news gloomily, and Count Piper, Charles's chancellor, insisted that the king abandon this foolish campaign and return to Poland, where Stanislaus would be forced to give proper tribute. By leaving the wretched Russians behind, Charles would even be in a position to make peace and resume the war at a better opportunity. He still held all the advantages when he wasn't stuck in the Russian quagmire. Better, surely, to bring these advantages to bear and attack Peter's beloved Petersburg, for example, than to lose by proxy in this terrible wasteland. But Charles, to Piper's dismay, remained obdurate. No withdrawal could be made, and no ground given to the sinful Tsar. A reckoning was coming, and Charles was determined to deliver Peter's judgment. At this mostly insignificant town in the corner of Russia, two empires were destined to clash. Poltava, the name synonymous with the rise of Russia, the decline of Sweden, and that historical event known as the Paradigm Shift, may seem on the surface to have little at all to do with Poland, and you may indeed be wondering why I've dedicated so much time and attention to Peter and Charles's affair while Stanislaus sulks in Poland. Well, the main reason is because I think it's interesting, and it adds context and meat on the bones of the overall Polish narrative. But another reason is for the battle we're about to see. Because you see, while Poltava is known as the moment where Russia triumphs and Charles's invasion came to a screeching halt, it also marked the moment when the independence of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth became practically impossible. In the aftermath of this battle, you see, Peter would be suddenly in a stronger position than ever before to project his power into the western reaches of his lands, and as a result, he was able to bring about a new Russian policy, which a century before would have seemed impossible. The once unequal alliance between Augustus and his Russian friend Peter, thanks to Poltava, became one where Augustus depended utterly on Peter's power and good graces to reclaim his Polish throne. Once installed, Augustus would do everything and sacrifice anything that Peter desired in order to hold on to it, and Tsar Peter would do anything to keep him there. As the war with Sweden had taught Peter, a docile, friendly Poland meant a secure and insulated Russia. Such an approach towards the Commonwealth did not automatically lead to partition, though. Peter's epiphany regarding Poland would never have carried so much weight had the Commonwealth not spent the last decade ripping itself apart and dividing into factions of varying degrees of power and size. It is the ultimate coincidence of Polish, and indeed Russian, history that just at the moment that Russia eclipsed its Swedish rival on the battlefield, its once formidable Polish neighbour was also at its lowest ebb. Rather than allow its fortunes to recover, rather than allow the Commonwealth to empower itself and perhaps challenge Russia, as it had done in the past, Peter elected to implement a gradually increasing hold on Polish sovereignty, which would only increase with each of his successors. The often forgotten Polish Civil War, which Charles XII's invasion in 1704 had kickstarted, was arguably the catalyst for Peter's projection into the once glorious Commonwealth. It was the bitterness, infighting, and petty jealousies within that conflict which remained strong for the next decade and which set the tone for the Commonwealth in the rest of the 18th century. Far from recognising the looming Russian threat confirmed by Poltava, Commonwealth nobles saw greater threats among their rising and falling noble peers or from the machinations, imagined or otherwise, of their king. The ultimate irony in Commonwealth history is one we'll see repeated time and again over the 18th century. So concerned were the nobility with the prospect of their king becoming an absolutist ruler, they never seemed to stop to consider the dangers posed by the ambitions of an external, genuinely autocratic and absolutist ruler, the Russian Tsar. Neither Charles XII nor Peter Romanov could have imagined the implications for Polish history that their upcoming battle would have. To this point, the Commonwealth had been a vital ally of the Swedes, but as Stanislaus's refusal to come to Charles's aid showed, its officials were still capable of pursuing their own policy when they saw fit. The question of Polish independence was not yet one which concerned either Charles or Peter. Poland was the useful pawn, but a sovereign pawn nonetheless, with independent institutions and a head-wrecking constitution that made a straight-up takeover of the Commonwealth seem quite impossible. Russia had also been knackered by the Tsar's devastation, and of course Charles's invasion, and the kind of foreign agreements that were later put in place to take pieces of the Republic for themselves had scarcely been imagined by either Russia or its later Prussian and Austrian powers. As before, it's important not to see one event as leading automatically to the other, but as far as exclamation points go, Poltava is a pivotal one, stunningly pivotal, before and beyond which different eras of European history can be said to reside. But let's get back to the battle here. Charles's 19,000 men attacked Peter's 42,000 men on the morning of Monday, the 28th of June, 1709. While on paper presented as the triumph of the Tsar over the king, in reality, Charles had never been so indisposed to lead a campaign. Still recuperating, but on a litter, Charles could not sit up, and he was little better than a morale boost for his men, who were led by a commander we've met before but you probably don't remember, Rentschild. The commander who had earned fame for his brilliant victories at the battles of Freustadt and Klisov. The problem was, Rentschild didn't see eye to eye, either with Liebenhaupt or with Count Piper, but he would have to work directly with Liebenhaupt at the Battle of Poltava. While we often take for granted the decisive Russian victory, it is worth considering what might have been had Charles's commanders actually liked each other. As it happened, Rentschild hated speaking with Liebenhaupt so much that he neglected to tell him the plans for battle which Charles had communicated to him, and he also failed to keep him updated over the course of the battle itself. The failure in communication is reminiscent of the Crimean War's charge of the Light Brigade, and the results were just as catastrophic. The absence of an able, unifying commander like King Charles at Poltava was keenly felt that day. Without his unifying presence, and depending instead on the impartiality of his commanders, Charles had suffered a major defeat even before his severely outnumbered ranks had assembled on the field. Charles's plan was followed, though, even if his direct command would not be. Charles's idea, communicated to Rentschild, was to move with speed towards the Russian lines, to attempt to overwhelm them, and then to surround the camp where the Tsar was said to reside. Once they were surrounded, Charles could then cut off the major line of retreat for the Russians, and through this combination, Peter's forces would have to either attack him or starve. It was daring, hideously dangerous, and also utterly brilliant in its scope. Because, consider this, had it succeeded, it would have been up there with one of the greatest military manoeuvres of the early modern era, and certainly the greatest comeback in King Charles's life. As it was, a combination of a divided command, an underestimation of the Russian soldier, and a serious numerical inferiority turned this encounter into Charles's worst disaster. From the very beginning, trouble hit the Swedish battle line on the morning of the 28th of June. Recon had been done far too late in the day, and when it was done the night before, it was discovered that the Russians had built their earthen defences in front of the main army in the field. This meant that the struggle to seize these lines would be far harder than previously anticipated, and things only got worse from there. In the confusion of the first major cavalry battle, an uninformed Liebenhaupt elected to move to the right of Rentschild, in the process opening up a huge gap in the Swedish lines, where he had been ordered to stay parallel. Rentschild's brutish behaviour seemed to have persuaded Liebenhaupt that he could achieve more when not stuck to his least favoured person on the battlefield, but the separation of the cavalry under Rentschild and the infantry under Liebenhaupt would effectively doom the Swedes. In the meantime, another Swedish commander had wasted too much time attacking the reinforced line which the rest of the army had moved past. Rentschild had never told this commander that the rest of the army was up north, and in the end this isolated pocket of Swedish soldiers was forced to surrender. Before 6 a.m. then, the Swedes lost about 4,000 men, and the true extent of the battle had not yet even been realised. At around 9 a.m, the Russian Tsar made the decision to leave his fortified camp and present his whole army to the Swedes, confident in its numerical superiority, as much as the renewed professionalism of his troops. Peter looked onto a hellish battlefield scene, where the Swedes already appeared to be on the disadvantage. Lievenhaupt's infantry, ordered to return to support Renskjold's cavalry at a pivotal moment, was pummeled as it crossed in front of the Russian cannon. Earlier in the day, the decision had been made to leave the Swedish cannon behind because these would hamper the Swedish advance. Now, these decisions were becoming lamented mistakes. With the Tsar moving his full army out, it was clear that everything was now on the line, but it was very far from an even contest. Charles's overall numbers were plummeting to as few as 10,000 through a combination of wounded, captured, and killed men, and none of his commanders seemed capable of working together effectively. The swan song of the vaunted Swedish infantry was thus a hopeless advance made by a pitifully small collection of men, but it still displayed echoes of its previous brilliance, even despite all these shortcomings. Incredibly, Lievenhaupt's infantry did actually break through the Russian lines, but when the brave Swedish commander glanced back, he realised that his comrades had been left behind, and from this point, the Swedish line began to disintegrate. There was just too much firepower coming from the Russian lines, and the combination of Russian canister shot and disciplined musket fire cut the Swedes to ribbons. In their thin lines, the Swedes couldn't match the overwhelming Russian firepower, and pockets of the army were soon isolated and cut off. "All is lost!" yelled Renskjold, plunging himself into the thick of the fighting. Renskjold would be one of the most prized prisoners caught on this day. It was, in many respects, a tragic end, because the once glorious Swedish legions were hopelessly, helplessly cut down without any possibility to defend themselves or give answer. And, in the process, the Swedish Empire itself received a mortal wound on the field of Poltava, and its king nearly followed it. 21 of King Charles's 24 stretcher bearers were killed. His stretcher was shattered, and a random officer had to place him on his horse, whereupon the king's old foot wound opened and blood began to drip all the way to Charles's meeting with Lievenhaupt. "What are we to do now?" Charles asked. "There was nothing to do but try to collect what remains of our people," Lievenhaupt replied. Both men withdrew to the Swedish camp outside of Poltava and brought up Cossacks to guard the outside of the defensive position. As Charles accepted that his gamble had failed, Peter gave thanks in an impromptu service in the battlefield. The Battle of Poltava was over. The cream of Sweden's army was left behind on the field of Poltava. Charles could barely count 8,000 men by the battle's end, having begun the day with 19,000. In comparison, Peter lost not even 1,500 out of his 42,000 men, a clear statement to the fact that the overwhelming Russian superiority in numbers had worked wonders. Contrary to his past experience, Charles's forces had been plainly unable to properly bring their vaunted professionalism to bear. Field Marshal Renskjold, the Swedish Chancellor Count Piper, and several other Swedish generals were now in Russian hands. Arguably the two most important figures after the king himself were now Peter's prisoners, and Peter was ecstatic. One imagines the 9-year burden falling away from him as he sat to dine with the Swedish VIPs that had been captured that day. Both the Tsar and his Swedish guests understood that Charles's advance was now finished. His army and its support base had evaporated, and he would have no option other than to flee or negotiate terms. For his part, Peter had to ensure his soldiers were fed and rested as they pressed their superiority in the campaigns to come. Peter's letters home testify to his, understandably, wonderful mood. Writing to his wife Catherine, Peter said, "I declare to you that the all-merciful God has this day granted us an unprecedented victory over the enemy. In a word, the whole of the enemy's army is knocked on the head, about which you will hear more from us." To his other willing courtiers and ministers, Peter sent this letter. "This is to inform you, by God's blessing and the bravery of my troops, I have just gained a complete and unexpected victory without much effusion of blood. These are the particulars of the action. I drew immediately our infantry out of the entrenchments to oppose the Swedes, and placed our cavalry on the two wings. The enemy, on seeing this, made a movement to attack us. Our troops advanced to meet them, and received them in such a manner that the enemy deserted the field of battle after little or no resistance, leaving us in possession of a number of cannon, colours, and standards. In a few words, the enemy has met with the fate of Phaeton. I can give you no account of the king, not knowing whether he be in the number of the living or gone to sleep with his fathers. I congratulate you on this good news, and beg all the magistrates and officers of my empire to consider it a happy omen. A happy omen, indeed, for this victory was the beginning of a succession of triumphs which would crown Peter not merely as a czar who was great in stature, but also great in endurance, in rule, and in victory. It is fitting that Peter should compare Charles's great loss here to that of Phaeton. Phaeton, if I'm pronouncing that right, hopefully I am, was a mythic Greek figure who sought to prove his divine legitimacy by riding his father's sun chariot, only to lose control of the machine, release the reins in a panic, and set Africa alight, and then, just for good measure, he was struck down by Jupiter's lightning bolt. Phaeton's story was told both by Plato and Ovid, and it remained a popular legend in the classical readings of Peter's era. It is perhaps all the more fitting when we consider the epitaph on Phaeton's tombstone, which supposedly read, "Here Phaeton lies, who in the sun god's chariot fared, and though greatly he failed, more greatly he dared." The seeds of Russia's empire had been sown, and next time we'll see how all such seeds, including the sweating King Stanislaus back in Poland, reacted and responded to the news of Poltava, as well as the impact it had on the wider Russo-Swedish war. Until then, though, my lovely patrons, you've been great. Thanks so much for listening to episode 9 of Poland Is Not Yet Lost. My name is Zach, and I'll be seeing you all soon.